I'm Kim Kastens from the Monteverdi Earth Observatory and the Education Development Center. This is work that I did at EDC, however. And I'm talking about strategies for supporting students' exploration, working towards being able to work with big data. So our symposium title is Learning Science from Scientific Data. And so I started by asking myself, well, why is this a good thing to do? Why bother? And there's two sorts of sets of reasons that appeal to me, at least. One is that it gives students the opportunity to actually engage with the evidence base that lies behind the big ideas that we are teaching them in their science classes, rather than just having them take it on authority from a textbook or a diagram or an illustration. But the second is that the world is facing a lot of really big problems right now, and making some decisions that are not necessarily very good decisions. And I feel that one way to improve that situation is to raise up a populace that has, number one, the skills, and number two, the disposition, the habit of mind of using data as part of their toolkit when they're trying to solve a hard problem or answer a difficult question. So that's what we're trying to get to. We're trying to get to people who can use professionally collected large data sets, complex data sets around ill-structured problems. But to get there, a lot of other things have to happen. And as both speakers have emphasized, it's a long process, starts early, and takes a long time to accomplish. And I've been thinking of it in terms of several different phases that you have to go to on your way to this professionally collected large data sets, beginning with little kids engaging in unstructured observations with their human senses, then transitioning from there to young students working with small data sets that they collected themselves. And then there's another transition to working with large, professionally collected, complex data sets around problems that are fairly well defined. And then finally, this last challenging transition brings you to the point where you can work at a professional or adult level with complex data sets. So we think that there's a challenging transition. It's a long, hard process, no matter how you think about it. And we think the transitions from domain to domain are particularly difficult. So this talk is going to be structured around this trajectory, and we're going to telegraph down into this trajectory at three different points. There are many difficulties and challenges along the way, and I'll sort of hit on three particular parts, starting with what precursor cognitive skills have to be in place to underlie the later ability to work with large data sets when you grow up. And this part of the talk shares thinking with Jess Gruppen, a developmental psychologist at EDC. So there are many kinds of thinking you could think about. One we've been thinking about is this realization that in the world, events leave traces, and that by looking at those traces, you can sometimes make inferences about what the events were like. So here is a piece of mountain range, and a geologist could look at this and say, by looking at this trace, I can say that there was a compressional event that where there was compression across this region that caused these folded and faulted mountain ranges. So that kind of thinking is called abduction or abductive inference. And what happens is you're given a set of facts or observations, like that mountain range in the previous image. Your challenge is to find one or more explanations that are consistent with the observed facts, using your knowledge of the system and using plausible assumptions to constrain the hypothesis space within which you're looking for this explanation. Now, this is something that scientists do, but we also think it's something that can be learned and practiced at quite a young age. Engage in abductive inference from this set of observed information. So you can probably make some fairly confident inferences here. I would say with a high degree of confidence that the glass used to be vertical. The milk used to be inside the glass. Something came along and knocked over the glass and spilled out the milk. And I can moreover constrain the nature of the thing that came along. It was smaller than a bulldozer, because a bulldozer would have squished the glass. It was bigger than a feather, because a feather wouldn't be strong enough. I can't pinpoint it, but I can constrain it. Likewise, I can constrain the time. It wasn't within the last 5 minutes, because then I would have seen it happen. But it wasn't more than 2 weeks ago, because then the milk would be all stinky and dried out. So I can constrain the time, I can constrain the agent, But I can't pinpoint either one of them. And that's a very scientist-like form of thinking, but we think it's one that can be started with very young children. So we think there's a sequence by which this way of thinking might develop. First, you say things that the child would say things that are not actually pertinent to the question of how did this happen, and then would offer a single concrete adamant hypothesis, like the cat knocked it over. And then would move to a phase where they could entertain the possibility of more than one hypothesis. Well, maybe it was the cat. Maybe it was my baby brother. And then finally would reach a degree of sophistication where they could talk in terms of bounded variables. These, again, are very scientist-like ways of thinking. So this is the alternative working hypothesis of the historical sciences, when you can hold in mind simultaneously the possibility of the cat and the baby brother. And this is the organizational strategy of computer models, where you can bound phenomena or times, but you can't pinpoint them exactly, and you step through and try all the different times. So, and we think that there's a continuum from these kinds of everyday reasoning experiences through the kinds of reasoning that you see in middle school curriculum through scientist data. By the way, this is from Ocean Tracks, the same thing that Bill was talking about. And that as you go sequentially, you have more elements, you have more complexity, you're farther removed from direct experience, you require more learned knowledge about the system, but nonetheless, many of the underlying components of the reasoning are in common. So we think we should be trying to understand what these reasoning processes are that you build in early childhood that underlie your ability to work with data later in life. So what might these be? Events leave traces. Some things about what causes objects to have certain form. Form follows function. Form reflects formative processes. Sequence constrains causality. Other kinds of real fundamental understandings about how the world works that we use as part of our skill set in thinking about data sets. But they haven't been articulated in this sort of a way, and so I think this is a useful way to pursue our thinking about data. So now let's telegraph into another point of this sequence, the transition from small student-collected data sets to professionally collected large data sets. We think it's a really crucial transition. As a community, we've put a lot of energy into helping students learn from small data sets, learn how to collect small data sets. This part of the work, by the way, shares work with Ruth Krumhansel and Margie Turin. But we've spent a lot of time as a community having students learn and teachers build capacity to help students learn from small data sets. How can we leverage that to transition to working with large data sets? A lot of changes have to happen across this transition. They can somewhat be isolated from each other, but they all have to be accomplished. You have to go from having an embodied or experiential grasp of the setting where the data were collected and the methods with which it was collected to really having basically metadata in data that comes to you from the Internet about how the data were collected. You go from a few dozen data points to vastly larger numbers of data points. You go from simple, transparent tools and techniques to sophisticated tools and techniques which are powerful but less easy to understand, less transparent. You go from interpreting one data set at a time to interpreting multiple data sets with interactions and multiple data types. You go from looking up values, what was the salinity at noon, to attending to patterns, seeing and interpreting patterns. You go from a common sense line of reasoning to reasoning that draws on spatial, temporal, statistical lines of reasoning, multi-step chains of reasoning, multi-threads of reasoning. And all of these things are all sort of confounded. They're all happening at the same transition. So how can we scaffold this? My colleagues and I have thought about a number of different ways to do this. I'm going to talk about two of them, but I'll just mention several. There's using pre-selected snippets of high effort to insight ratio data, nested data sets, prediction, and a hypothesis array. You can think of these as design patterns or instructional templates or instructional sequences. The first example would be what we're calling nested data sets, and actually the C-phages is an example of this. What happens is the students collect and interpret a local data set, then optionally students from multiple schools combine similar data sets to aggregate a larger set, and then a larger professionally collected data set which encompasses the student data set. is used to expand in space or time or some other dimension the kinds of interpretations that students can do. So an example is the day in the life of the Hudson. On a certain day in October, students from up and down the Hudson go to their local piece of the river and collect a common suite of data, including salinity, temperature, dissolved oxygen, and so forth. And then they combine their data with schools from other schools up and down the river. This is salinity data from schools up and down the Hudson. And then they can use professionally collected data to explore changes in time. So they have the experience of collecting their own data, making a first inscription, seeing the connection between the reality and the inscription, but then they have the larger data sets with which to make a more ambitious, more conceptually rich interpretation. So this is an idea of an example of a kind of a template that could be expanded. Another is prediction. In the prediction template, students, based on some kind of a model, a conceptual model, a physical model, or in our example, a computational model, make a prediction about what the data will look like under certain circumstances. Then they go into the data set and begin to make their data visualizations with that prediction in mind. So in this particular example from a paper by Gould, Sunberry, and Krumhansel, the students have predicted that when an exoplanet, a small planet, passes in front of a star, there will be a decrease in the amount of radiation brightness received from that star, and then when the transit of the exoplanet is finished, it will go back up to its previous level. So then the data is collected on their behalf, and then they see something that has some similarity to their prediction, but also has the messiness that is inherent in real data as opposed to simulations. So the idea we have, as I said, we have several of these instructional templates articulated, and our idea is that you can use the different templates in different contexts with different contents, building capacity amongst both students and teachers for these reusable approaches, just like we use, let's say, Think, Pair, Share or Jigsaw Puzzle or other kinds of classroom activities, build these kinds of repeating teaching strategies. And we could also use this to create an efficient research agenda in that we could research the affordances and pitfalls of particular strategies rather than being in the trap of having to be expected to evaluate each and every piece of instructional materials independently. Okay, our last helicopter down into thinking about this has to do with the nature of what's needed to be a professional data scientist and how that overlaps with what's currently being taught in schools. So this work was done with Ruth Krumhansel and Joe Ippolito at EDC. We used a process called DACUM, Developing a Curriculum, which is a well-established methodology often used in technical and vocational education, but EDC has modified this to be suitable for emerging professions. So we did this for the emerging profession of big data-enabled professional. So the premise of this methodology is that you gather insights from experienced and respected practitioners, and the outcome gives you a definition, an articulation of the duties and tasks of the job, and then an articulation of what knowledge, skills, tools, and behavior do skilled practitioners in this field need. So you begin by gathering together this group of skilled practitioners. In our case, they came from many different disciplines, but they were all data scientists or data enabled professionals in their respective profession. So we gather together information from all these different fields of endeavor, asking them over the course of 2 days to help us understand what are the tasks, skills, knowledge, and behaviors of a big data enabled specialist. So with the help of a skilled facilitator and a very engaged panel locked up in a small room for 2 days, we came up first with a definition. The big data-enabled specialist is an individual who wrangles and analyzes large and/or complex data sets to enable new capabilities, including discovery, decision support, and improved outcomes. So although they came from wildly different fields, they all recognize that this is what they do. This is the essence of what they do. And then continuing on with much more scribbling and editing and reorganizing, the group began to articulate duties and tasks. So duties would be, duties would be things like defines the problem, communicates findings, And then after much ongoing editing and validation through an online survey by another 100 practitioners, this turns into a beautiful matrix that looks like this. There are copies of the whole thing in the back of the room if you'd like a copy of your own. Basically, this outlines the rows are duties, and each cell is a specific task, as, for example, defines the problem, which would be identify stakeholders and articulates the question, and so on and so forth. So this is useful. It's useful for people who are in industry who are trying to mentor and develop a career path for such individuals, but it's also interesting for people in education to know, you know, what's the end goal that people are going to be needing in the workforce. So we then did, so the duties turn out to be defines the problem, wrangles data, that turns out to be a term of art, manages data resources, develops methods and tools, analyzes data, communicates findings, and engages in professional development. So then, being educators, we asked, how does that compare with what the current education system is doing now as far as preparing students? Now, of course, we have no idea what the education system as a whole is doing as far as data skills. We have no data with which to ask that question. But we do have a sort of aspirational statement of what, at the K-12 level, we would like the students to be able to do. So this is the Next Generation Science Standards and the framework that lies behind them, which is cast in terms of three dimensions: disciplinary core ideas, cross-cutting themes, and practices of science and engineering. And among those practices is, number four, analyze and interpret data. And some of the other practices are also very rich in using data, like engage in argumentation from evidence and develop explanations. So there's a lot of data using permeating the Next Generation Science Standards. This is to remind me that if you're a college professor, you should not expect that students at this level of understanding data will be showing up in your classrooms next year. This is very aspirational. You know, it's something that that may be coming along in the near future. What we did was we did a comparison of the tasks that were in the occupational profile and the tasks or the competencies that are implied by the performance expectations in the Next Generation Science Standards. So I went through all of the performance expectations in all of NGSS and identified ones which had some overlap with the tasks in the occupational profile and categorized them all as either abundant in NGSS, totally absent in NGSS, or sparse in NGSS. It was an interesting exercise, and of course there are many that don't appear. There are many things that you wouldn't expect to be taught at the K-12 level that professionals are asked to do. However, there is actually some very interesting overlap. So here are some of the areas that overlap. Under the duty of defines the problems, actually NGSS has an important emphasis on determining the stakeholders' needs, like why are you answering this question? Why are you looking at this data? Articulates the question, translates questions into a research plan. Plan and develop an investigation is strongly emphasized in NGSS. Designs the experiment and develops the domain knowledge, the scientific knowledge around the data. Under wrangles data, it's strong on collects data. The other aspects of wrangles data are not there by and large. Analyzing data, there's also some important aspects of analyzing data that are highlighted by professionals as things they do, as an important part of their workflow that are already showing up in NGSS. Things that are absent or nearly absent from NGSS, performs data exploration. Now, that's the kind of thing that Bill is giving the students the capacity to do in spades. Good. That's really not there in NGSS. That concept is not there. Identifies outliers and anomalies, something that scientists would recognize as important. There's very little under manages data resources, much of which is pretty technical. Maybe you don't want to be teaching that in K-12, but there is this one interesting one about applies ethical standards, which I think we could be starting with much younger. Determines levels of confidence. That seems to me one worthwhile, which is closely related to identifies limitations in the data. So if you were teaching college, you could look at this gap analysis and say, okay, that's our sweet spot. We're going to start where NGSS lies, ends up, and we're going to bring our students to the point where they're ready to be professionals in this field. So there's some ideas in here about, you know, where we could be, we're aspiring to do well, and where we could do some more thinking. So the bottom line here is it's quite a long, complicated, involved path to grow a populace that has the skills and disposition to use data as part of their toolkit when they're confronted with a hard problem or a difficult question. I think it needs to start quite early, and it needs attention at many steps along the way. There are many interesting challenges, both from a research perspective and a pedagogical perspective, along that trajectory. And actually, science education is where it's happening right now. Data in adult life shows up in all sorts of corners of the world, from telecommunication and social media and so forth. But our place to improve data skills, especially around complex data sets, is sitting in the science curriculum. That's the place in both K-12 and undergraduate education where these questions are being addressed and where's our chance to have an impact. Thank you.